William had been on one of his long expeditions in Croom Woods. In his imagination, he was an intrepid explorer searching for a lost tribe, cutting his way through dense jungle where no white man had ever set foot before. The virgin forest had certainly left its marks upon him. It had clutched at his collar and hair with its thorn bushes. It had besmeared his face and clothes and knees and boots impartially with its bogs. Suddenly he found himself at the edge of the wood. There ahead of him was a large garden and a large house. It didn't look like an ordinary house. Its windows were uncurtained. Within sat many girls of all sizes, with bobbed hair or plaits. Surprised and interested, he crept nearer. A small woman wearing glasses stepped out of a French window and called him. "Here, boy," she said imperiously. William was uncertain whether to obey or to turn and flee. But a small girl with a dimpled face and dark curly hair looked out of the window and smiled at him. And William obeyed. He entered a classroom with a dais at one end. A large number of girls sat about the room at easels. The lady with spectacles took William by his ear and led him up the room. "The little model I had arranged for is unable to come, girls," she said, "so I'm going to ask you to draw the gardener's boy." "It must be a new gardener's boy," said a tall, thin girl. "I've not seen him before." "Don't talk, Gladys," said the mistress. "The point is not whether he is a new or old gardener's boy. The point is you are to draw him. Sit down, boy." William, who had already picked out the dimpled, dark little girl by the window, sat down quite meekly. A girl in the front row gave a shudder. "Isn't he dirty?" she said. "Never mind," said the mistress. "I want you to draw him as he is, just an ugly, dirty little boy." She apparently looked upon William as something as inanimate as a plaster cast, but the ferocious glare which he now turned on her informed her that he was not.
"Try to look a little more pleasant, boy," she said, faintly.
"I do hate having to draw ugly things," said the girl in the front row with another shudder.
A look of apoplectic fury overspread William's face. But the little girl at the window with the dimples and dark curls said,
"I don't think he's ugly."
William's expression of fury turned into a sheepish smirk.
"Don't talk about him, children," said the lady. "Draw him."
They worked in silence. William looked about him. The frowning, critical, appraising glare of 16 girls did not embarrass him at all. Only when he caught the eye of the little girl with the dimples did a dark blush overspread his earth-bedecked countenance.
"I think I've got his ugliness all right," said a short, snub-nosed girl earnestly, "but I can't quite get his cross look."
"Let me see, dear," said the mistress.
She took the sketch and examined it. William craned his neck and looked with interest at his portrait. Certainly the sketch suggested a gorilla rather than a human being.
"Yes," said the mistress doubtfully, "you've caught a certain likeness."
William opened his mouth indignantly when the girl by the window said suddenly,
"I don't think he looks cross."
William closed his mouth and his ferocity softened once more into a sheepish grin.
"He keeps looking different," complained a girl in the back row.
"Stay the same, boy," ordered the mistress imperiously.
At that minute a bell rang and there was a stampede of girls out of the doorway.
"Gently, girls," said the mistress, preparing to follow them. "Boy, stay and straighten up the room and put the easels away."
William stayed behind and, to his joy, discovered that the little girl was staying behind too. She remained at her easel, gazing out of the window. William began to move easels about without any definite plan of campaign.
"I'm not the gardener's boy," he said to the little girl.
She did not answer.
"I'm an explorer."
She made no comment.
"I've explored places where no white man ever set his feet before."
Still no answer.
"I once had all my teeth out without gas,"
he went on, with deliberate untruthfulness, but with a vague desire to restore his self-respect. Suddenly the little girl put down her head on her arms and began to cry.
Oh, don't," said William, greatly distressed. "What's the matter? Have you got toothache?" "No." "Has anyone been unkind to you?" "No, I'm homesick," wailed the little girl. "I want to go home." Well,
you go home then," counselled William encouragingly. "You go home. I'll take you home."
"I can't."
"Why not?"
She dried her eyes.
"Well,
I'm in a play we're doing this afternoon, and if I don't turn up for it, they'll know something's happened, and they'll catch me before I get to the station and bring me back.
No, they won't, said William. I'll help you. I tell you, no one'll ever dare stop me. I've been where no white man ever set his feet, and I've...
Yes, said the little girl, quite unimpressed. But don't you see, I can't go at once, because I've not had dinner yet, and I'm hungry, and if I run away after dinner, they'll find out at once and catch me.
She burst into sobs again.
Don't, said William desperately. Don't cry. It's all right. I'll take care of you.
I say...
The light of inspiration shone suddenly in his face.
I'll take your part in the play, and then they'll never know you've gone, and you'll get home all right.
She stopped crying and gazed at him. Then the hope died from her face, and she burst into a wail.
But you don't look like a fairy, she sobbed.
I could make myself look like one, said William grimly. I bet I could. Look at me now.
He gazed into the distance, his features composed into a simper that suggested to an impartial observer a mixture of coyness and imbecility.
Oh, no, she wailed. It doesn't. Oh, no, don't.
Well, he said, if it looks wrong, can't I cover my face or something?
Her tears ceased. Her eyes shone.
Oh, I forgot, she said. There's a veil. They won't see your face. Oh, you are a nice boy. Will you really do it?
Listen, I'll tell you just what to do. I'm Fairy Daffodil. I'll get the clothes in a second. There's a cap of daffodil petals and a veil that comes down from them over your face. So that's all right. And you have to hide behind the green bank at the side of the stage, behind a lot of green stuff and leaves. You go there early, about 2, and then when the others come, they'll be so busy getting ready that they won't bother you. And when it begins, you wait there till someone calls Fairy Daffodil, and then you come out and bow and say, "Here am I, speak, Queen." And when that bit's over, you just sit down on the stool by the side of the Queen's throne, and you don't speak again. It's quite easy. Oh, it is kind of you, dear boy.
William's freckled countenance flamed again.
Oh, it's nothing, he said modestly. Why, I've been where no white man's ever set his feet before. This is nothing to that.
The guests swarmed into the school hall. In the middle of the second row sat William's father and mother, Mr. and Mrs. Brown. The room was tastefully decorated with leaves and bracken.
I like to come to all these things, don't you? Said the lady next to Mrs. Brown. And they're always very good about sending out invitations to their little affairs.
Oh, yes, said Mrs. Brown vaguely, and it all looks very nice.
The curtain rose, and the two ladies continued their conversation in a whisper.
Well, I must say, said Mrs. Brown, I like to get right away from home sometimes, because really at home I'm on pins the whole time not knowing what William's going to do next. At a place like this I feel safe. It's nice to be anywhere where I know that William can't suddenly rise up before my eyes doing something awful.
Fairy Daffodil, called the fairy herald on the stage. A figure arose from behind a leafy barrier, took an ungraceful step forward, tripped over the leafy barrier, and crashed to earth, leafy barrier and all. The yellow headgear rolled off onto the floor, revealing a tousled head over a stern, earth-streaked face.
"What's your boy like?" said Mrs. Brown's neighbour, who was not looking at the stage. "I don't think I've ever seen him."
But Mrs. Brown's smile had faded. Her face had become a mask of horror. Her neighbour followed her eyes to the stage. The strange apparition was in no wise disconcerted by the contretemps with the leafy barrier. It did not even trouble to recover its headgear. It stood in the middle of the stage and said loudly and ferociously, "Here I am." There was a dead silence. Fairy Bluebell, who stood near, inspired by a gallant British determination to carry on in spite of all disasters, prompted,
"Speak."
William looked at her haughtily.
"I've just spoke," he said.
"Speak, Queen," hissed Bluebell desperately.
"It's not my turn," hissed the Queen back.
Bluebell stamped.
"Say, speak, Queen," she said to William.
Oh, said William. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot that bit. I forgot there was something else. Speak, Queen. That's all anyway, isn't it? Where's the stool?
He looked round, then calmly sat down on the stool, sublimely unaware of actors and audience completely paralysed around him. Slowly, very slowly, the power of speech returned to Mrs. Brown. Her horror-stricken eyes left the stage. She clasped her husband's arm.
John," she said hysterically. "It's William."
Mr. Brown, too, had gazed open-mouthed at this wholly unexpected apparition of his son. Then he recovered himself.
"Nonsense, my dear," he said firmly. "Never seen the boy before, do you hear? We've never seen the boy before."
But we have, John. It's William."
"Who's William?" said Mr. Brown wildly. "There isn't any William. Temporarily, I've disowned him. I've disowned him till we meet again under the shelter of our own roof. I don't know how he got here or what he's going to do, and I don't care. He's nothing to do with me. I've disowned him, I tell you."
"Oh, John," wailed Mrs. Brown, "isn't it awful?"
Everyone agreed afterwards that somebody ought to have done something at once. But the headmistress was out of the room supervising the tea arrangements, and the mistress who was prompting said that for all she knew it was some fresh arrangement made behind her back. Anyway, the play dragged on. But no one took any further interest in the play. The whole interest of the audience was concentrated on the curious apparition, inadequately clothed in yellow butter muslin, who had taken its seat at the foot of the throne. The apparition itself seemed unaware that it was attracting any attention. It sat down and gazed around it, stern, bored, contemptuous. Then a light, as at some happy memory, came into its face. It pulled up the butter muslin to its waist, revealing muddy boots, muddy legs, and muddy trousers, plunged its hand into its pocket, and brought out a nut, which it proceeded to crack with much facial contortion and bared teeth. At this point, the headmistress entered by the door at the back of the hall. Her face wore a proud smile. Her eyes wandered slowly to the stage. The proud smile dropped from her face. The fairy daffodil had cracked the nut and was proceeding with every appearance of concentration and satisfaction to extract the edible part of it. With the air of one dashing to a heroic rescue, the headmistress plunged up the hall, drew the curtain, and made a grab at the fairy daffodil.
"What is the meaning of this, you wicked boy?" she said.
The fairy daffodil abandoned his half-eaten nut, dodged what he rightly suspected to be an avenging hand, and fled.
"Catch him!" panted the headmistress. "Catch that boy!"
The entire cast, followed by the entire staff, dashed after William. Gathering up his impeding yellow robe, William fled like an arrow from a bow, out of a door at the back of the hall, across the garden, towards the front gate. He would probably have outrun his pursuers had he not collided with a little girl and a tall man who were just entering. The little girl gave a cry of joy and said,
"Oh, it's the nice boy, Daddy."
Then to William,
"I met Daddy on the way to the station, boy. I didn't know he was coming, and I feel quite happy now. He's given me a lovely tip, and I've remembered that I'm playing in the netball match next week, and I'd hate to miss that."
At this point, the gym mistress, the vanguard of the pursuit, arrived and seized William by one ear. The art mistress arrived next and seized him by the other ear. The head girl arrived next and, not wanting to be out of it, seized him by the scruff of his neck. The rank and file of the pursuers now arrived and seized him by any portion of his anatomy that happened to be unoccupied. Thus, seized at all available points, he was marched off to the headmistress. It was an hour later. The visitors had been collected again. The prizes had been distributed. The headmistress, at the earnest request of the tall man, had pardoned William's escapade. The visitors were having tea in the garden. William sat at a little table with the tall man and the little girl. He was blissfully happy. He was consuming unlimited quantities of cakes, and every now and then the little girl smiled at him, very sweetly.
"I won't be so silly any more, Daddy," she said.
"One minute," said her father. "I can see a business friend of mine there. Hello, Brown," he called. Mr. Brown approached the table.
"Oh, this is my daughter, Brown," said the tall man.
William tried to avoid his father's gaze.
"And I'm not sure who this youngster is, so I can't introduce him properly. All I know about him is that he's been where no white man ever set foot before, and he's had all his teeth taken out without gas. But perhaps you know him."
"I didn't know either of those facts about him," admitted Mr. Brown dryly. "But," his sardonic eye forced his son's to meet it, "but I have met him before."